Yeah, the Novocaine is mostly worn off, so you really can't tell. No, it's fine. I'm all right.
Okay, okay. You guys are jerks. You had me worried. Hello and welcome to the EDH Rec Cast, brought to you by the best deck building site on the web for the Commander format, EDH Rec. My name is Joey Schultz, and I'm joined today by my lovely co-hosts. First up, the Speedster, whose article series takes you from 60 to 100. It's Matt Morgan.
Joey, I was surprised to see a spider came in for an interview at my office today. Turns out we're hiring web developers.
I want to laugh at that joke, Matt, but it makes me deeply arachnophobic, so don't like that.
Just appreciate it for what it is.
I will try. Next, the man whose articles remind you to look in the margins, Dana Roach.
Last night in a game, I died to four consecutive Rakdos charms. Ask me anything.
I would love to, but just a moment, because I still have to introduce myself. And I'm Joey Schultz, author of the Commander Showdown series. All these articles and more can be found at edhrec.com, along with some awesome featured community content, such as other Commander podcasts and gameplay videos. EDHREC itself is a fantastic deck-building resource that compiles data from decklists all over the internet to provide helpful recommendations for new Commander decks. And here on the podcast, we're going to give all that data a little more context. But before we do, Dana, I'd love to ask, four consecutive Rakdos charms?
Yeah, I was playing my Jeru deck and my Super Friends deck, and I had Elspeth Sun's Champion out, had made a few tokens. Cathar's Crusade was also part of that nonsense, so I had, I think it was six or nine creatures out that were, you know, anywhere from nine power down to three power because of the Cathar's Crusade, and got hit with a Rakdos charm by one player, and somebody else leapt at the opportunity to Wild Ricochet it, and then... copy the Wild Ricochet, and I think it required Nirhu Maha, the legend with Flash from Dominaria, also came in that copied the Wild Ricochet again.
Oh, yeah, the wizard copier lady, yeah.
So, yeah, I just got clocked for, you know, whatever, my nine tokens times four. That was the end of me, but if you're going to go, that's a stylish way to do it.
You went down in a blaze of glory.
That was a lot of resources invested in, but it was worth it. I did not feel bad about that death.
That's legitimately cool. I, as long as we're sharing stories, I had some amazing fun games too. I put a picture on Twitter of this. God. If you guys listen to Magic Mike's and know Erin Campbell at all, Dredge Queen, praise be unto her, first of her name. But she gets really, really giddy and cannot stop laughing whenever an interaction that is so disgustingly amazing comes across her table. And that's basically the state that I got into, because I had the opportunity in my Edgar Markov Vampire Tribal deck, I had the opportunity to cast New Blood on someone's The First Sliver. And New Blood doesn't just gain control of someone else's creature by tapping one of your vampires. New Blood turns that thing into a vampire and changes that creature type, whatever it was, into the word vampire as well, across the text of the entire card. So I had a vampire version of The First Sliver, which gives my vampire spells cascade. So on the next turn, I cast one 4-mana vampire spell, which triggers Edgar Markov and triggers The First Sliver, and cascaded into another vampire spell, which triggers the cascade and also triggers Edgar Markov. And it kept on going into just an absolutely disgusting torrent of vampire goodness. And I could not stop giggling. I got into that Aaron Campbell state of mind where I was just like, like it became a madman. I was, oh my God, it was so, so dirty and so delicious.
I think I saw the picture you posted.
Yeah, it's inappropriate.
It was so much fun, guys. I could not. I can't give it a straight face now. It was so, so bonkers. I mean, they immediately destroyed me because they had to, but it was so much fun while it lasted.
Well, and I think you also, Joey, just recently purchased your plane tickets to Las Vegas.
Yes. Yes, I did. Yes, I did indeed. So Dana and I are going to be present at the Magic Fest in Las Vegas. I'm so excited for that, too.
Yeah.
And I will be in Maine.
Yeah, Matt would be unable to make this one. So
stupid work.
I'm going to do a quick shout out here, too. I'm participating in a rotisserie draft on Twitter. If anyone follows me there, you've seen some picks happen. We just got the commanders picked. But the guys at the Brothers War cast, I guess they go by Commander Social now, have set one up with a few other content creators to basically draft commander decks. To raise some money for charity for Dell Children's Hospital. So I'm participating in that. We'll be drafting commander decks over the course of the next several weeks leading up to Vegas, and the plan is to actually play those decks then in a couple pods there, and money raised will be going to help some kids out.
That's really, really cool. And yeah, you can just follow on Twitter to see all of the cards that you're drafting. I've been seeing it pop up every so often where you've got like a budget limit and then you pick a new card and send it back to the other people in the rotisserie draft. And like your budget is slowly dwindling down, but you've also got to juggle which cards in the commander format, which is all the cards, are available to you. Like that seems really complicated.
Right. In the first three rounds, we each got to, we picked three commanders. So I've taken my three and then we had a 1 day break to think of your strategy. And then by the time this show airs, we'll be well into the swing of it. So we start drafting tomorrow for actual cards for our decks. And it's, of course, one and done. So once someone takes that card, it's no longer available to you. So I need to figure out what I need to take in the first round here. I'm not sure what if I want to go removal or creatures right away or draw. I don't know. So I'm just going to see what everybody else does and maybe go the other direction.
Crazy. That's really cool.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to see how it plays out.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing it in Vegas as well. Matt, we're really sorry that, you know, you can't make it there because work and work sucks.
I know.
But how about for the time being, you regale us with some stories of fun Magic that maybe you played recently.
So I was at GP Denver this past weekend. Some of my buddies came into town, played some Commander games. Actually, I got to play Old School, which was really fun. I cast a Black Lotus, a real Black Lotus, and Moxen and all sorts. I cast like $35,000 worth of cards in one turn, and I felt really weird about it because that's more than like I've ever like had in my hands at one time. So, but I did play some Commander games, which was a lot of fun. I finally got to play Kaikar. I picked up some of those, well, one of those for my formerly Shu Yun deck, and holy cow, the card is so freaking explosive. I love it. Like it was super fun. I didn't even need like Purphoros or Impact Tremors or much of that out there. It's almost like a Simic Commander where it rewards you just for playing a bunch of spells. So
I can't tell if that's a compliment or an insult.
It's a compliment. After this weekend, I was kind of looking and I was like, I just need to put either a bunch of X spells in there or a bunch of just one mana red spells in there so I can just like bolt. And it basically becomes a mini ritual because I get a spirit that I can stack for another red mana, and then I can cast another one. Oh my gosh. It was crazy, and it was super fun, and I love it.
That's really, really bonkers. I think you made another note here about something with Moldrotha as well.
So I did actually get to play my Moldrotha +1/+1 counters. I finished off the deck to where I want it to be with all the +1/+1 counters themes. And Avenger of Zendikar, guys, in case you didn't know, is an insane Magic card. So I got, I think it was 11 tokens off of Avenger of Zendikar coming into play. I had Hardened Scales out, plus a Pier, and something else. And then I played a Fetch Land, fetched into a ramp spell, and then... Oh, and then somebody had the red enchantment where all creatures have haste. So I one-shotted the board after resolving an Avenger Zendikar.
Yeah, because you'd play one land and they'd all get like 3+1 counters. You'd crack the land. You'd go find another land.
Plus
like,
another three, plus a ramp spell, which got me two lands. And yeah, it was gnarly. So it was super fun playing a Moldrotha deck that actually can close games quickly. I was impressed. I was happy with myself. It was a good time.
That's a really cool. You pull the mask off of the Avenger Zendikar and find out that it's actually Crater of Behemoth.
Pretty much.
You're like, Old Man Jenkins, what is this? That sounds really great. I've got one more story that I'd like to share. And that's just that one of my best friends is teaching his girlfriend how to play. She played, you know, a while ago, but she's like sort of, you know, getting back into the game. And we've got a Tuvasa deck made for her and she's, you know, hanging around with our group to play, and she's holding her own really, really well, so much to the point that I suddenly realized she's making observations that people I know who've been playing Magic the Gathering for like 5, 6, even 10 years, she's making observations that even those people have not quite grokked. And I'm just like, dang, like one of them in particular, just like something that I hadn't even heard put this delicately before. Someone was telling her like, oh man, I really think that we've got to destroy that thing. And she looks at him just dead on. She's like, no, you think that you need to destroy that thing over there. The things that are a threat to you are not a threat to me. And I was just like, dude, yeah, Yeah, that's true. And that's just like one of those things that took me probably 3 years to actually realize, to actually learn in this game. But probably my absolute favorite moment is when she's like, yeah, no, magic's really fun. I'm really liking this. But, you know, I don't like having to pay mana for all of these creatures. That's really getting in my way. And I just looked at her and looked at my friend and was like, dude, she's a keeper. You have to marry her. That's like my mantra, because I also don't like paying mana for creatures. I just rip them right out of the graveyard. I'm just like, marry her. That's the best thing I've ever heard.
You should have told her about your friend Matt's favorite card in Alurin, where you never have to pay mana.
But why bother with that when you can just pull the big stuff out of the graveyard? It's so much more fun that way, Matt.
And that's what
anyway,
you think.
It was just a bunch of really, really fun stories. But hey, we can't just talk about the stuff that we're doing. There's other stuff happening out there in the Magic universe too. For example, we've gotten our first look at some potential Brawl deck spoilers, including cards from Throne of Eldraine. So before we get into our main topic for this week, which we haven't even touched on yet, how about we also address some of the new stuff that we've seen from the upcoming product?
Yeah, we got to look at two cards that will be in the Brawl deck that are technically set in Throne of Eldraine in that plane. We got to see a potential commander and a mana rock.
So let's start with the mana rock, just because it's easiest. It's actually very, very simple design. 2-mana artifact that doesn't enter untapped. It's called Arcane Signet. So it's just 2-mana rock that taps to add 1 mana of any color in your commander's color identity. So it's like a commander sphere, but it's 2 mana and it doesn't sacrifice itself to draw a card. What do you guys think?
I think it's very good, and I think dang near every deck's going to want to play it that isn't playing green already. And I know a lot of people don't like it, but I actually think it's a fine card to have around because it's one of those obviously good cards for newer players to identify and kind of help them in their deck building decisions. I extremely powerful, yes, but I don't think it's something we should be mad about.
Yeah, I've kind of came around on it as well. I still think they should have thrown some kind of caveat on the tap ability, like it deals a damage to you or it gives all opponents 1 life or something to make it not so obviously amazing. But, Benny Smith on Twitter made a good point that it's not like people are really doing anything with their mana bases that's fun necessarily. It's kind of the homework you have to do to get your deck to the point where your deck becomes fun. I mean, that's a good point. Like, it's if people can get there easier and let their deck do the thing it wants to do, maybe that's not a bad thing. So I still think it's a bit of a lazy design, maybe, but maybe we just need a little more fixing and this gets it there for people who can't afford to go buy that, you know, Mox Diamond or run a, you know, Opal or buy the other really expensive, super low-cost mana rocks. Maybe this is something that everybody else can afford to get. And frankly, if you're running all those big power mana rocks anyway, at that point your deck is so strong, 1 more 2-mana rock doesn't necessarily make a difference for you. So it's probably fine.
Right. I think there's so many. If you take Darksteel Ingot, take off the Indestructible, this is probably fairly costed by those standards. Or Commander Sphere that doesn't cantrip. I mean,
right.
it's only ramping you by one. I think a lot of people maybe have overreacted about it, but we are Magic players. We all have our moments. So
I think also like people were just concerned about its availability since this is coming up
yeah.
in a Brawl deck, and we're not sure whether it would show up in Commander precons, and we definitely want to make sure that it's available for Commander decks for the people who want to play Commander instead of just Brawl. So I think that that's probably where some of the stress comes out around it. I do think that a design like this was basically inevitable, although I'm also not necessarily happy about that, since I think, Dana, the word you'd said was like it's not original or something like that. It sort of feels like it's a little too obvious, and that kind
sure.
of, you know, doesn't excite me as much. But at the same time, you know, mana rocks don't need to be the things that excite me. So I'm also not like up in arms about it. I am impressed that we're getting another mana rock that hopefully is going to, you know, grease the wheels of all of the decks that need the help. It's better to have more of this type of thing out there than less would effectively be the thing that I've come down on. So I am excited to get my hands on one, assuming that I can get my hands on one.
Well,
how about that?
I do believe it's also going to be available in the special collectors packs.
Right.
So hopefully there will be enough of those that get cracked to make it not requiring you to go buy a bunch of Brawl decks just to get hold of Arcane Signets.
Well, and I'm sure that they'll be making more Brawl decks that contain things like this in the future, and it will make its way into Commander precons, you know, after that point as well. So, yeah, this is going to be making waves, is what we're trying to say. It's, you know, it's a mana rock, which isn't always the most exciting thing to talk about, but this is going to be showing up in a lot of decks because it's greasing them wheels. We've also got a Commander, Chulainn, Teller of Tales. Matt, you want to tell her all about it?
Stop. I know exactly
what
you...
I will not stop.
All right. So Chulainn, Teller of Tales, 2 and Bant colors, so green, white, and blue, for a 2/4 human druid with vigilance, and also reads, whenever you cast a creature spell, draw a card, then you may put a land card from your hand onto the battlefield. And wait, there's more. Pay 3 mana, tap it, return target creature you control to its owner's hand. It's weird because usually this doesn't have white in the mana cost.
Right.
Usually
effects
cynic
like this are just sort of Tatiova, where it's just like rewarding you endlessly for the things you are already doing. I get
Pretty
you.
Much. Basically, they slapped vigilance on the card just to justify the one white pip.
Yeah, it's pretty insane how good this is, so.
Yeah, combine Tatiova with Karametra and you get something a little nasty. I think a lot of people have already, you know, way before this show will even come out, people have already noted the amazing combos that are available, not just in these colors, but with this specific ability, especially if you're routinely bouncing creatures back to your hand with White Mane Lion type effects. This is a little nasty. It feels like it's doing a little bit much. I'm scared of it.
It's a lure waiting to happen.
It's not just that it does much, it does a little bit much for you automatically without you having to input anything at all. This is a self-driving commander.
Yeah. Right, Alluren, Matt, that's a huge thing for it because you can just, Alluren and a White Mane Lion or something, you'll just play free creatures, draw a bunch of cards, put lands into play. They don't even come into play untapped. The lands just...
It's insane. It's pretty insane.
It's... Pretty gross. So now that we've looked at it and called it really gross, are you guys building this?
Oh, absolutely not.
Probably not, yeah.
Really?
Honestly, I would get made fun of for running this commander in my shop.
Really?
Oh,
that's
savage. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's, if you didn't build Yarok, you're probably building Chulainn, so I don't know. Blue-green just has so many splash colors to just get even more busted these days.
But, you know, to not be entirely negative about it, I've seen a few people make different points online about how it's probably a good splashy commander to attract new players to the format because they're going to see that and their eyes will light up at the thought of, you know, playing creatures and drawing cards and dropping lands, doing all the things it does. So I don't disagree with that entirely. I think that's a reasonable point.
Yeah, this is a commander that, like, if people aren't doing busted stuff with this, which, like, I'm not sure whether I can trust that you're not going to do something busted with Chulainn when I see it across the table. But if people aren't, then this is another one of those commanders that also greases the wheels. I think my only real umbrage with it, because, like, I should actually preface this by saying, if this is the type of power level from cards that we're getting in the upcoming Brawl decks, I'm okay with that. I like seeing more cool commanders, because we don't always get them in the actual sets. I mean, this past block from Ravnica has been absolutely excellent, and Dominaria was great too, but sometimes the commanders that we get in a set are just kind of duds and they don't make huge waves. So if we've got cool commanders coming up in another product, I think that that's a net plus.
I agree completely. And also, this commander probably isn't that powerful in Brawl either. I mean, I'm sure it's good, but right. Like, it's not the same thing as it is in Commander, where you're dropping Birds of Paradise kind of cards regularly. You don't have access to those in Brawl.
Right. I do just sort of wish that, you know, this particular commander, when it comes to basically any commander, I do wish that when it, you know, can be tuned and optimized, that it doesn't go infinite so easily.
Yes.
I think that's my only main thing. I like it when, you know, the cool value stuff that a commander can do is something that isn't going to, you know, break things in half. And Chulainn, just looking at him, even kind of glancing at him, you're kind of like, oh, if you optimize him a little bit too much, then you're going to go probably down a path that you didn't originally want to when you first started building the untuned version of that deck. So, you know, that's kind of a weird misfire, but that's also just my personal preference. So that's sort of my only take on it. These do look like a very powerful pair of cards.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, Joey. Like, this seems like the type of commander that if I built it, I would sit there and realize, like, oh, dang, I just found another combo on accident that I didn't mean to put in the deck, but it's in the deck now, so we're going to do this.
Yeah, it kind of feels like it will be a Primal Surge-esque thing, or, like, Primal Surge feels great that first time or two you cast it and win the game because you have no non-permanents in your deck. But then after that, you're like, well, do I want to do that? How often do I want to just cast Primal Surge and win? I think people will probably get bored of it, and I don't think it'll, you know, see a crazy amount of play just because it kind of plays itself for you.
Right. We saw that same effect with Prime Speaker Vanifar, which all of us had expected that was going to become the most built from that particular set. And then it turned out that Tesa Karlov stole that title instead, because Prime Speaker Vanifar was also one of those commanders that seemed to sort of build itself. So, you know, maybe if this particular one, I mean, there's still a pair of exciting and powerful cards, but if this one isn't particularly, you know, revving our engines, we've still got other Brawl decks upcoming. So I'm personally excited to see what else is coming.
Yeah, for sure.
Because more cards that can impact Commander, I think, is really, really cool. Anyway, we've dwelled on some non-main topics for a while now. So how about we actually get into the real meat of our show? What is our topic this week, fellas?
The timing of your commander.
Yeah, your commander's got to be on time, and they've got to be on the right time, because if they're late, it might not work out well for you. And if they're early, it might not work out well for you. It is a weird sort of conundrum to try and figure out when your commander is going to be most optimal to play. And so we're going to try and parse out some of those particular details. You guys ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
I'm all set.
So, yeah, basically the impetus behind this particular show was just that there are so many moments that I've seen in my own experience, you know, my misplays of when I should be timing my commander, and also that I've seen some other folks do too, where I'll cast my commander and it will do nothing and then it will die and I will have gotten basically no value from that commander. And then there are also times where I've seen, you know, even myself, I'll play my commander at a time that doesn't seem completely optimal, and I don't feel like I got as much value out of it as I should. So we're going to try and figure out, you know, different categories of times, basically, that would be most optimal for different commanders. Because it can really mess with your game plan. If you wait to play a commander too late, but it wanted to be played as soon as possible, you'll have lost value. But if you play your commander too early and it dies and you got no value, you've time-walked yourself. So it can be pretty complicated.
Yeah, there's a lot of variables to bear in mind when you're making those decisions.
Yeah, it's a little crazy, but I tried to parse it into, this is just sort of my personal working theory, but I hope that it resonates with other people as well. There are sort of four general categories that I consider about when to cast the commander, and they go, for me at least, as follows. So there are the commanders that you want to cast ASAP, and then number two, the commanders that I've sort of labeled, quote, wait for it, where you want to wait for a little bit of value. Then there's also the commanders, number three, that are the, quote, blowout commanders. You play those basically like they're a spell. You play them and then you win the game basically that turn. And then finally, they're the commanders that you almost never play. When you play them, it's as a last resort. And those are sort of the four general categories that I have seen about when I want most to cast my commanders. Does that seem like something that sort of resonates with you guys?
Yeah, that seems like a logical breakdown to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think those are four starters. If you're, unless you're, you know, doing some super deep Joseph M. Schultz style dive, I think that's a very good, it's a very, very good place to start.
Matt, are you accusing me of overthinking things?
No, never. Maybe.
Never, indeed. So let's just sort of take those categories one by one. The main ones, ASAP commanders, let's go to a few examples of those. ASAP commanders are the ones that you want to run out basically as soon as possible, because they're what makes the deck tick. They might be really low drop creatures, which makes them easy to play and then to recast, or they might be really expensive, but you want to ramp them out as fast as you possibly can so that the deck can do its thing. What are some examples of commanders that you guys play ASAP?
I mean, I think anything base red usually is going to be a pretty aggro and pretty, you know, cast it quick commander. Purphoros and Krenko decks are kind of those training wheels, according to Dana, type commanders. But you want to get them out quick because you are going to end the game quickly afterwards. I think some of the more aggro decks, even outside of that, like I think Yuriko is probably a good example of a non-red commander that you want to get her out quick. And then start getting all that value accrued and you know, doming people for those cards that you draw.
Yeah, I think for commanders that I play in particular, Edric's Flymaster of Tress definitely qualifies. And I think Reki History of Kamigawa does as well. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason those qualify for that is because you need those, or you want those commanders in play first before other things happen. And I think that's true of kind of a lot of the ones we're talking about here. You know, you want Purphoros out before you start making tokens so it can deal damage. You want Animar out before you start casting creatures so it can get counters. So that seems to be kind of one of the common factors a lot of these things have, is the deck wants a commander out to take advantage of the things it does afterwards.
Right. One of the big ones that comes to mind for me, my brother has a Kalia of the Vast deck, which cheats Angels, Demons, and Dragons into play for free. That deck needs to be fast, or else it's not winning the game, because if it gets to the late game, well, you got to play Kalia as early as possible, because if she's cheating things into play, but it's a late game where everyone's already casting spells that are of, you know, those Angel, Demon, and Dragon mana costs anyway, you're not getting as much value as you could when you're just, like, just swiping them straight into play for free and totally terrorizing the board with them. So there's a ton of value that you can get by playing these things super early. Tuvasa the Sunlit also comes to mind, actually. I'd mentioned that as a previous example. Tuvasa is going to be drawing you cards, just like Edric and sort of like Eureka. Like, you'll be drawing cards. You don't want to play that late, because if you do, you'll have lost out on all those cards that you could have been drawing. As another sort of, you know, flip side to that, those are the ones that, you know, help you with a bunch of value really early, but all of those cards that we named have really low mana costs. There's also the ones that have the really big mana costs. So I'm thinking of, for example, Maelstrom Wanderer. I feel as though that particular deck wants to ramp out Maelstrom Wanderer as fast as it possibly can, because then you're going to get two Cascades and then cheat even more stuff into play. That's a high cost thing, but you want to ramp that into play as soon as you can, because it's going to start doing gross, gross stuff.
Yeah, that one definitely jumps out at me as well. I always think of Maelstrom Wanderer. That's one of those commanders where when you're playing against it, you're counting the mana to see how much time you have until it comes down, and it's never enough time.
No, it's never.
Yeah, that thing makes a big impact. What are some other big mana ASAP commanders that you guys think?
I always think of Rakdos Lord of Riots as one you have to worry about for the same reason. You want that down early to deal damage, then you can start casting those Eldrazi or whatever. It's almost always something that you can abuse, that ability where creatures cost, you know, colorless mana less based on how much damage was dealt to opponents that turn. So they want to get Rakdos down so they can deal some damage, and then, you know, if you deal 5-6 damage, start casting those 5-6 mana colorless spells just for free and bring those Eldrazi into play, or artifact creatures, or whatever it is. So that's another one that always jumps to mind that people seem to want to jam out as fast as they possibly can.
Matt, any ideas come to mind for you?
No, because I don't tend to play a whole lot of big mana type of commanders that you want to rush out. I think one that some people might play as an ASAP that I actually kind of tend to wait a little bit longer on is Omnath Lucas of Rage. That's definitely a big mana deck, but I see a lot of people playing it out ASAP, like they ramp and then they play their land and then play Omnath, but they don't have a way to play another land right away. And I think playing that as an ASAP commander might be wrong, actually.
Yeah. Oh. If you do rush out Omnath too soon, you can get to that point where you've blown all your land ramp spells to get Omnath out and then have nothing to proc those triggers on him once he's in play because you've emptied your hand.
Exactly. Yeah. If you rush Omnath out and you don't have a way to trigger him the turn you play him, you're probably doing it too quickly because there's no way to make sure you're getting value.
So what you're saying is that Omnath might actually fit not into the ASAP category, but into the next category, the wait for it sort of category that I had called it. The types of commanders where you want to wait on those until you can glean at least a little bit of value. You don't want to rush them out immediately, because if you get them out ASAP, it's risky. They could die without actually doing anything. So among that category, I had labeled a couple of other things, and I think Omnath is a great inclusion to that. But this is where I would put my Marin of Clan Nel'Thoth commander, because if I just play Marin as soon as I can, and then I don't have any creatures in my graveyard, and I don't have any creatures that can sacrifice to get me experience, if I wait a couple of turns around the table, she could easily die without getting me anything at all. So what I want to do is wait with my Marin to make sure that I've got either a creature that can die to get me an experience point, or a creature in my graveyard that I can reclaim with her ability back to my hand to get some value from it. I don't want to play her as soon as possible. I want to play her soon, but not as soon as possible. I need to get a little bit of value. So you're saying that Omnath fits into that category instead.
I would make that argument. Yeah, I think it sounds silly because you're doing so much ramping, but you want to make sure that you're spending a great deal of mana already to get Omnath onto the battlefield. So you have to do more of what you want to be doing just to recast him. So you want to make sure that you're getting some sort of value, because the commander is so expensive that it really, really hurts and sets you back if you invest all that mana to get nothing out of it.
Yeah, I mean,
I kind of saw this
last night. I was playing a game and a player had a Muldrotha deck out, and he was not having any luck getting things in the graveyard. And there was a point in the game where he had Muldrotha mana available, but wasn't casting his commander because there was nothing in the yard. So at that point, you know, you're risking putting your commander out there and having it eat some kind of removal spell when you have no option at that point in time to do any of its abilities because your graveyard is empty. So that's one where I think Muldrotha fits that Marin mold as well, where you want to have fodder there in your graveyard to abuse, or you're just putting a target on a commander that isn't giving you much upside.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's just it. That's wise on behalf of the player that you saw last night, because they know that if they run Muldrotha out like it's ASAP, then it's not going to do nearly as much. Like if I play, you know, if I try to ramp as soon as I can into a Muldrotha, it's going to have a fundamentally different effect than if I try to ramp out as soon as I can into a Gishath Sun's Avatar, for example. Gishath, I want to ramp into as soon as possible to put a bunch of stuff onto the battlefield. But Muldrotha, I would rather, you know, wait for it to know that I'm going to get some value. And that's sort of a key difference between those two different categories. An ASAP commander is one that really makes the deck tick, but a wait for it commander is likely to work better with those commanders in play, but not like wholly depend upon them to function. You know, Marin or Muldrotha, those are still going to be perfectly fine. And then the Marin and the Muldrotha will make those things a whole lot spicier. They'll make them better, but it's not quite the same thing as some of those other ones, like the Yuriko example, where like the deck is kind of depending on her to be in play as soon as possible and as often as possible to really do its thing. So there is a sort of a timing distinction, but also a thematic distinction, a structural distinction to them as well. What are some other examples of wait for it commanders you guys think?
I learned pretty quick this weekend, Kaikar is a commander that you don't want to tap out to cast. And I think that's kind of our theme for all of these guys is if you tap out, is that going to be something that sets you back more than it sets you ahead? And for me, with my commanders that fall in this category, that is. Like Kaikar, I don't hit 4 mana and cast Kaikar. I hit 5 or 6 mana so that I can start doing a little bit, get some value back. And so it's not just, I played my commander, oh, you answered it right away, cool. Well, that sucks. I at least had a chance to get something out of having my commander on the board.
Yeah, preach. That's exactly what I organized my Feather deck around as well. If I play Feather on turn 3, I will lose that game because people are going to immediately remove it. What I need to do is wait until I've got some type of protection spell and then I can play Feather. So I'm frequently not playing her until probably turn 5, sometimes 6, because I need to make sure that I have a suite of protection to ensure that she's not going to immediately kick the bucket as soon as she, you know, comes into play. But if I just played her like she was ASAP, well, then I probably would just have to be stuck recasting her again on turn 5 anyway for 2 more mana with command tax because people are going to get rid of her. I need to wait and make sure. So yeah, Kaikar, absolutely. That totally makes sense.
Yeah, and you know, Glissa the Traitor in my Glissa deck kind of functions the same way to a degree. She's aggressive, you know, 3 mana to put out that 3/3 with Death Touch and First Strike. That's a really useful attacker early on. So I understand the temptation to want to play her out quickly, but you probably don't have any artifacts in your graveyard to bring back anyway. And on turn 3, she's a really great removal target. She's much less of a great removal target on turn 5 or 6 or something when someone else may have their Muldrotha out or someone may have their, you know, Kali of the Vast out or something, which are a much more threatening target. And when someone kills that Kalia, then you'll get the Glissa the Traitor proc to bring an artifact back. And hopefully at that point in time, you've had time to get an artifact in your graveyard to start recurring stuff. So the temptation is there in that case to play Glissa ASAP, but experience has kind of taught me that's one where I definitely want to wait until that time is right and there's things in my graveyard and there's scarier threats in play, because if I do it too soon, she's just going to get removed.
Yeah, I love that example. So let's move on now to our third category, blowout commanders. These commanders grace the field when you're ready to win. They're, like I said earlier, practically spells. It's basically that you're casting a sorcery rather than actually casting a creature, because they will do such ridiculous stuff to the board when you play them. And you don't want to play them a moment too soon, because if you do, you really lose an amazing window of opportunity. And it's a lot like I had mentioned the Feather example or the Kaikar example that you had mentioned, Matt. Like, if you play these too soon, you're not going to get nearly as much value as you could if you wait to play them at the exact right moment, which is going to be way later in the game. So some examples of these for me is going to be the Mimeoplasm. Like, I play the Mimeoplasm when I am planning on basically destroying everyone as soon as I can. I'm going to, for example, put Lord of Extinction and a bunch of cards in my graveyard so Lord of Extinction's power gets huge, and then make Mimeoplasm a copy of Walking Ballista. So he's got like 100 counters on him, and then I use those counters to just ping the rest of the board. Or I'll turn Mimeoplasm into a copy of Skitherix and give him 6+1 counters as well. Mimeoplasm is there to one-shot somebody, basically. But if I played him like he was ASAP, then I'd get basically no value out of it. And if I play him like he's a wait-for-it sort of commander, I'd get also not as much value as I could, and people would definitely try to remove him. Mimeoplasm is one of those blowout commanders for me. What about for you guys? What's a commander that you play that just demolishes as soon as it enters play?
I'm not currently playing the deck, but I think you at one point in time, Joey, also had a big mana Draenna deck with Draenna, Equestria, Bloodchief.
Yeah.
And Draenna's fine early on, and you can kill creatures with her, but she's going to get removed because she's an immediate threat to anything anyone else has in play. The best time to play her is at that point in the game when you have built up enough black mana. You just kill somebody. You drop her, throw some grease on her, and somebody dies.
Huh. You know, I've never played my Draenna deck like it's a blowout, but maybe I should, because
yeah, I mean, you know,
and
you don't have to. Her ability is useful earlier on if you want to play her on a wait for it status, because it is always useful. But what I had found was then she gets removed enough times. And when I get to that point in the game where I can just start one-shotting people, she costs, you know, 9 mana to cast, which then removes my ability to one-shot somebody because I'm spending so much mana to cast her.
Huh. You might be learning me a lesson here, Dana, because I had never considered that. But that's why I'm not good with that deck. That's a really good idea. I'm going to have to. Okay. But no, like, so that's actually the thing. I think that this particular category is the most difficult to discern and to strategize around, because these commanders, I think, are disguised like they're an ASAP or like they're a wait for it style. You know, Gave Guru of Spores, for example, is the type of commander that I'm like, oh, yeah, if I play that early, I could get a couple of little bit things of value here and there, maybe get some blockers or whatever. No, that's not how you play Gave. When you play Gave, it turns into an accidental combo engine. A Gave deck can throw three random cards, like literally any three cards at random out of the deck onto the table and accidentally go infinite. That's what Gave does. And the same is also true of Breya. Like, I could play Breya early, but Breya is also like, when that hits the battlefield, it's probably destroying people with a ridiculous combo. That's just sort of how those commanders work sometimes. So, but it's difficult to see. You don't always catch that at first blush. Those commanders can be very difficult to find out if they're the type to immediately win you the game as soon as they come in. They're just going to do such gross stuff.
I'll say it's tough to kind of tell by just looking at the card unless you see it in play, too. Like, if you look at Shroom the Hegemon, there's nothing about that card that screams it's a blowout commander unless you see it in play and realize all the different combo lines. And then you're like, oh, that's just a card that when the person's in position to cast it, they're casting it because they have the combo in.
Matt, what are some examples that come to your mind?
So I think of decks that I play, Niv-Mizzet, Parent, is probably one of those blowout commanders. It looks like a commander that some people might want to play out ASAP or wait a second. I prefer to play Niv as I'm going to establish the board. I'm going to set up because of how color hungry Niv-Mizzet is. You need a lot of setup to do that. But once you play Niv, you're ready to go. You play Niv-Mizzet, and then you almost kind of storm out. It's good that a lot of people don't have access to Paradox Engine anymore, because that would get really out of hand really quick. So Niv-Mizzet, I think, for me, is one of those blowout commanders where I play Niv, and I have my goal. I know what I'm trying to accomplish that turn, and then the next two turns from there. I think anybody who watched the game nights where Josh Lee Kwai played Golos, the new Pilgrim Solemn Simulacrum, they saw the turns where he played him out a little early and he didn't have the mana to activate Golos. And then you saw the turns where Golos came out and Josh had a chance to activate Golos' ability. So I think Golos definitely qualifies as that blowout. You wait a little bit, you set up your board, play the game a bit, and then you play Golos and you go ham. That's definitely one of those blowout type of commanders, just because of how powerful that ability is.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of these commanders are a little bit more obvious than others because they just seem to invite such a huge board state to become as effective. I'm thinking of, for example, Audric Lunark Marshall, who shares all of the combat keywords across your entire team. Obviously, you're going to want to have a big board full of things with a lot of keywords to make that as big of a blowout as possible. Edgar Markov, too. Like, you're not going to rush into him because he puts counters on all of your vampires. Clearly, you're going to want to have a lot of vampires. But some of them are a little less obvious, too. Two commanders that I've tinkered around with in the past have been Mazurek and Titania, both of which involve sacrificing things. It's kind of what I like doing. But the reason I think that I could never really get Mazurek to work was because I was trying to build that deck in a way that was counter to how he actually plays most optimally. Mazurek comes down onto the battlefield with a bunch of creature tokens in play. You sacrifice like five things, and then you've suddenly played a Craterhoof Behemoth. And I was preferring to find some type of engine that I could play Mazurek early and then start doing a couple of things over the course of many turns. And Mazurek actually wanted to be played in a completely different way. Titania as well. Like, I was like, oh yeah, Titania, I'll play her. I'll sacrifice a couple of lands here and there. And I'll, you know, over the course of several turns, I'll make a bunch of elementals. But what I actually found was one of the most optimal build paths for her was to play her all in one, sacrifice all my lands, and then have some type of haste effect like Concordant Crossroads to make all of my brand new out of nowhere elementals attack as soon as I possibly could. So, like, I was building with the completely incorrect eye towards those commanders when they actually were begging to be built in a different way to become more efficient. And, man, that was a tough lesson to learn.
Yeah, some of these you just have to be in that position and having played the deck or play against it to just see how they play out and how they're best as a blowout commander. I think a Najeela the Blade Blossom to a degree, you know, I've played against quite a few Najeela decks that kind of try to aggro her out, and you can also get in that position with Najeela where she gets too expensive to cast, whereas if you wait till that right perfect moment, you just auto-win the game then with infinite combat steps.
Gross. Very gross. Yeah, anything that's capable of going infinite kind of naturally slides into this blowout category, but also plenty of commanders that don't intuitively look it. I think that there's arguments to be made that a lot of commanders that appear to be a wait for it or an ASAP actually wind up in a blowout category. Nikusar the Mindraiser kind of comes to mind. That's the type of commander that I see people tend to want to put out as soon as they can, but it attracts a lot of negative attention. So what Nikusar decks instead do is wait for many turns, then play Nikusar, and then a chain of like three different windfall effects to make everyone draw like 20 30, 40 cards and kill everyone in one fell swoop. But that's not immediately obvious when you look at Nikusar because he says you draw extra cards. You want to get extra cards, right? Like, it's very, very weird to try and navigate that, but it's really worthwhile because it can really make or break your deck. It can really make the difference between whether or not that deck is as effective, and it can make the difference on whether or not you know what your opponent is up to. You know, if you know what those commanders are capable of and when they want to be played, that can also help you strategically against those commanders. What about our last category, the never play or the almost never, the last resort kind of commanders? What are some examples that come to mind for that category?
For me, I think Child of Alara, every single deck that I've ever seen playing Child of Alara at the helm, it's a, as my old football coach would say, the oh crap button, where everything's going wrong, you need a reset. So you play Child of Alara, you find a way to get that angry baby off the board, and you just start over again. It's just things are going wrong, maybe somebody's pulling ahead too far. Let's even the playing field, let's make sure we don't die, essentially.
Yeah, that's what a lot of these basically feel like. If you're casting one of these last resort commanders, it means you're in trouble. I'm thinking of Olero, Ageless Ascetic, who just wants to sit back in the command zone. If you have to play Olero, something's probably gone wrong. Or Enola has another Eminence ability as well. Like, Enola doesn't need to be in play to do her thing. Those are kind of the commanders that, like, if you're playing them, that means that you're in some pretty dire straits.
Probably.
Yeah, two ones from my own personal deck building I'll mention here is I have an Asperia Supreme Judge Sphinx Tribal deck, and Asperia is a perfectly fine card, but it's just not one that works that well until it's gotten to the point in the game where, like, there's been three or four board wipes cast or something and everyone's down on resources. Then it becomes really good for me because I can put it into play. It's got six power immediately. I tend to have multiple different double strike effects in there, which means you're on a two-turn clock then. And we're at the point in the game where I tend to have counter magic. I can protect myself. And if you swing back at me with Hesperia out, it draws me more cards and puts me further and further ahead as well at that point in the game when everyone's kind of starved for resources. So there's a lot of games I never even cast Hesperia because it never gets to that point. But very rarely am I casting it when I normally could on like turn 5 or 6. It's a 6-drop. You know, occasionally I'll have the mana on even turn 4 sometimes. I almost never am casting Hesperia that early.
You said there were 2 examples. I'm intrigued. What was the other one?
Mina and Den. I have a Mina and Den landfall deck. Huh. And I mean, Den is also a good card, but their primary use in that deck tends to be the bouncing a land back to my hand to give a creature trample and then replay it for the landfall effect. And there's enough other ways in the deck for me to do that that kind of becomes my last resource as well there when I'm out of ways to get the additional landfall effect and I need that one extra one because I'm out of lands in hand or I've already ran through enough resources. That's like that last little bit of gas in the tank I can switch over to when everyone else is out of gas. Having them in the command zone works similar to Hesperia in that deck as well, where it's what puts me over the top.
That's really interesting to hear, actually. Just looking at Mina and Den, I never would have categorized them as the type of, you know, I never really play at last resort kind of commander, because they just sort of strike me as like, oh, I want to wait for this and then get some value over the course of several turns, bouncing some lands. But you bring up an excellent point. The density of cards in your deck that do the same thing as your commander will have a direct impact on when and how you can play them.
Yeah, and you know, if I've played Azusa, Lost But Seeking on turn 3, I mean, and Den doesn't do me much good on turn 4. If I've dropped a, Burgeoning earlier on, that doesn't do me a lot of good either. So there's just a lot of times with that particular commander, the ability to bounce the land and play an extra land just isn't always something I can use on turn 4. So it just winds up being something I use when everyone's desperate for something late game, and it's kind of what gets me over the top.
Huh, that's really cool. I think that it's like just important to note also that like these are not hard and fast categories.
Right.
These are just some, like, there are plenty of commanders that can easily fit into deck types of any of them. Like, I think Mina and Den, you had just mentioned, was sort of a last resort commander, but also could easily be played in someone else's deck as sort of a wait for it, or they play it as soon as possible to get the additional land effects easily. I think that, like, Brea also, like, yeah, I had made a case that there's combo stuff that she's capable of, but it's also easily the case that other people want to play her as soon as possible, and that's perfectly fine for the deck that they're playing. Nikosar as well. Like, there are plenty of commanders that fit into multiple of these categories. It isn't necessarily that this is an inherent quality of any specific commander, just something that is a thought experiment that people should definitely focus on when they're intending to cast their particular commander. It's more of a person-specific thing than a commander-specific thing, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, for sure. Like something like Narset, Enlightened Master. You want to get Narset out usually as fast as possible, but she's also a blowout. She's also going to be the commander that comes out and just wins the game. So there's definitely some that have multiple quadrants to hit for sure.
Right. Is there one of these categories, I don't know, just is there one of these categories that maybe you'd say is more common than another? Or if that's too broad of a question, is there one of these categories that you're personally more drawn to than the others? Matt, what do you think?
I'm tempted always to kind of do a wait for it type of build with pretty much any of my commanders. I know Valduk seems like a very aggressive deck, which it can be, right? But I don't want to run him out naked and then I have to spend, you know, 4 or 5 mana to establish a board. I want to get some equipment down first so that when I play Valduk, I'm able to protect him a little bit better. I'm able to set up and just have some sort of a board presence where if they answer him right away, sure, it stinks, as with all commanders getting killed, but it's not the end of my world. I think a lot of players tend to treat their commanders in their decks as ASAP commanders, where, okay, well, I'm just going to play my commander on curve, and that's what I want to do every game. And, oh, why did you hit him with Swords to Plowshares? So I think people, it's kind of like what we talked about last week. You want to look a little bit critically, what role is your commander playing in the way that you built the deck? I think a lot of people tend to maybe rush things a little bit. So making sure that you kind of reevaluate what is the goal of the deck and how do I want to treat this? Am I playing my commander like a wait for it type of deck? But really it's, I want to wait. So this is an absolute blowout and I just win when I get my commander and untap with it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well said. Dana, is there one of these categories that maybe you tend towards a little bit more?
I definitely tend to avoid blowout commanders. Number one, I don't like to have that level of threat levied my way in a game. I want to kind of slide it under the radar. It's my playstyle for sure. And I tend to not want to win the game usually in one fell swoop either. It's not a playstyle I really like. So I definitely try to avoid those categories. ASAP commanders I tend to avoid as well, just because it's not also a playstyle I really like that much. So for me, they tend to definitely fall into wait for it or last resort. I have a fondness for commanders that aren't particularly good to a degree.
Ain't that the truth?
So last resort.
You said it, not us.
Yeah. So there's definitely a degree of last resort there as well.
Man, that's funny. I think the wait for it is also the category that I tend to be most drawn to. I'm thinking now, when I saw the card Arcades the Strategist spoiled, and he draws you cards when you play defenders, and then he also turns all of those defenders into potential attackers by making them deal damage with their toughness, I saw him and I was just like, man, I'm never building this. I don't like it. And Arcades strikes me as one of those commanders that is simultaneously ASAP, I want to play it as soon as possible, and a blowout, because it can easily be played onto a huge board and then make a bunch of creatures attack all at once and just, you know, totally annihilate the entire table just by playing him. And both of those things are not things that I wanted to do. I tend to be very much on the wait for it. They're going to give me incremental value type of thing, which is why some of the other commanders that I was trying to build, like Mazurk, Titania, were so difficult for me, because I was putting, you know, my thoughts into one type of category, but they wanted to be in a different type of category. Yeah, things like Marin, Tesa Karlov, the things that I need to wait for a little bit of value, and then they'll grind out a bit more as the rest of the turns go on. That seems to be the thing that attracts me most as well. Are there commanders that you guys just absolutely will never, ever play unless and until you can protect them? You know, such as like with counterspells or with equipment like Lightning Greaves. Matt, you had mentioned Kaikar earlier, for example. Are there other commanders that come to your mind about things that you just never want to play without protection?
Like I said, Valduk is one that I don't want to run out with nothing else to do. I at least want to get to a combat step where I can play a couple auras at least onto Valduk. Omnath, definitely. I don't just tap out and not play a land at least. I will sandbag a land when I can, you know, cast Omnath, then play the land immediately after. So I at least get something for my troubles. A lot of my commanders, I think maybe the closest to an ASAP type commander is my Miri deck, where I just want to end the game as quick as possible. I want to, you know, turn things sideways, and Miri definitely makes that happen. But everything else is probably downshifted a little bit.
Dana, what about you?
I definitely, not that I would play necessarily, but I think if you're playing something like Atali Primal Storm, that's not a commander you should play unless you can protect it, because I think people see Atali and immediately are thinking, well, I'm just going to not let you attack, because if I let you attack, there's a good chance so much value happens. You know, even if you're not running Jocala Hops in your deck, there's a good chance so much gross stuff is going to happen that I'm never going to recover, so you just aren't allowed to attack. So I think that's the kind of one. I think Brago falls in that to a degree too. It's really like people have that mindset where if you're allowed to swing with Brago once, it's probably going to generate so much value that we just can't let it happen, so you better have a counterspell in hand. And I think commanders that blow up other people's stuff, I've seen a couple different Invictus Asmodi the Dire decks. When Invictus attacks, you destroy permanents other players control and kind of do a polymorph thing. People don't want to lose their permanents whenever you attack. I think I've seen a lot of Invictus decks where, again, that mindset is, I'm counting your mana and holding that Pongify, and the second you cast Evictus, I'm going to keep you from swinging in. So I think there ones that either have that game-winning ability on an attack or just have one that's going to blow up someone's stuff or something, you better protect it, because very, very often the playgroup is going to have that kind of mindset of, nope, you're just not going to do your thing.
Yeah, I mean, the commander that comes to my mind is one of what I think is probably one of my only, quote, blowout commanders, and that's the Memeoplasm. Like, if I play him without the ability to actually protect it with some type of counterspell or Lightning Greaves to give him haste to actually attack people, like, Memeoplasm has, I think, probably never survived a full round at the table. Like, it's just unheard of. And also another deck of mine that comes to my mind is Yennet. I built Yennet Cryptic Sovereign, and people are so afraid of the free spells that she's able to do that they just can't afford to let her stay alive. So when they see Yennet, I need to make sure that there's something that I'm able to do to make sure that they don't path her or something like that, because they're just too afraid of it. So like the free spells or the blowout definitely are the types of things that I want to make sure that I've got, you know, I've got some protection, especially if they are a commander that's like a linchpin to the deck's strategy. If the deck doesn't function without it, then I mean, oh my goodness, I can't afford, right? Like Marin, I can potentially put out there without having protection, but there are some other commanders. Like if you're playing Mizzix, I feel like it's dangerous to put her out there without some sort of protection, because I just don't know that she's going to be allowed to survive.
Yeah, I think Mizzix is probably one of those blowout type of commanders where I was going through these categories, I think Izzet probably has the biggest density of blowouts, where you play your commander and you just go crazy on the board. I mean, even stuff not the best, but like Melek, Izzet Paragon, or whichever his title is, Melek, that one, you can play Melek and then cast one spell and you might win the game immediately after.
Yeah, Izzet does some crazy stuff, that is for sure. And I just also want to put it out there, like, people need to make sure that they understand not just the timing, but also the role of their commander sometimes too. Like, if the commander's a linchpin to your entire deck, people are gonna come for that. Like, you cannot expect it to survive. People can't afford to let you keep that commander around. So it's a timing issue for sure, but it's also like making sure you understand the role that the commander plays, much like we were talking about on the past week's episode. Something that we haven't addressed yet is planeswalkers as commanders. I think this is sort of pretty obvious where a planeswalker...
This is an Oathbreaker.
Wow. I feel as though planeswalkers as commanders naturally fit into exactly one of the categories that we talked about, and that's the quote, wait for it. Because if you play a planeswalker ASAP, they could easily become attacked because you've got nothing to defend them with. But if you play them too late, well, then you're not getting as much effectiveness out of their loyalty abilities. Planeswalkers, you want to make sure that you can defend them with some type of blocker before you run out there. I feel like that's just a general rule, right?
Yeah, I mean, man, that's definitely true as far as when I play them. I'm not sure if everyone does that, but that's the first thing I'm looking for with a Planeswalker commander, or just the Planeswalker in general, is can I keep them alive for at least a turn or two to take advantage of their abilities?
Right. I built a Lord Windgrace deck, and I found myself putting in more effects like the Wood Elves or Farhaven Elf, because even though they're not as good as some of the other ramp options available to me, I wanted to make sure that I had some type of body to make sure that Lord Windgrace didn't hit the battlefield plus two and then immediately get walloped by someone else's commander.
Well, I think you get weird things also with partner commanders, where you get one that does one thing and one that does the other, and that can be a little tricky to manage sometimes too.
Oh yeah, partner commanders are a great example, and probably one of the best ways for folks to try and figure out where their commanders fit within these different categories too, because you're right, one partner tends to be the focus in a partner deck. They don't really split the jobs evenly, or at least that's been my personal experience with partner commanders, is that one of them is going to be doing the main heavy lifting, and then the other one is there to support it. So mixing up the timing on those could be really, really detrimental to your game plan. If you've got, for example, a Bruce and a Kiri deck, Akiri is probably going to be your main heavy hitter. She's getting bigger with all of your artifacts. She's going to be doing damage. And then Bruce will come in afterwards as the blowout. So Akiri is going to be like ASAP, and Bruce will be there to be effectively a spell that turns Akiri into a one-shotting Voltron. And that's really important. If you mix up the timing on Akiri and Bruce, you could lose that game.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference there. You know, that's a good one that I've seen quite a bit, is that that's a very popular pair. And yeah, I mean, knowing the sequencing there is the difference between killing somebody and not.
Right. Or I've got a Virtus and Gorm deck. Virtus would be as soon as I can possibly play him, and Gorm is, I guess, kind of my last resort. I basically never play him. I mean, I want to sometimes because he seems lonely there in the command zone, but he doesn't do as much as Virtus could. And you could easily build the deck the different way. You could easily build the deck around the other commander instead if you wanted to, but just the way that I've gone with it, you know, Virtus is the main engine there and Gorm is there as a last resort. And so you just need to make sure, if you're building partner decks, I feel like that's a great way to employ this type of exercise to see which commander is going to be your primary focus and therefore when they need to be played. When are you playing Thrasios? Is that your main focus? Are you using him to draw a bunch of cards, or is he going to be sort of your blowout where he draws you 100 all of the cards, like that kind of thing?
Yeah, where something like Timna in whatever pair Timna's in, Timna tends to be the ASAP commander. You're trying to get that value right away off Timna, and then many times the other partners is either one you're using as a last resort, or it's just a color enabler or something, but Timna's almost always one everyone wants that fast value off of.
Right. Vile Smasher comes to mind as another one. You play Vile Smasher as soon as you can so that it's going to start dealing damage, that kind of thing. Ravos, I think, presents a particularly tricky conundrum because Ravos gives an anthem, which seems like a blowout-y kind of thing, but then it also has a multiple turn engine kind of value thing where you are getting creatures back from the graveyard over the course of several turns. Like, yeah, that's a really, really interesting thought experiment for sure. Partner commanders, I think, are extremely illuminating when it comes to this category. There's also, if you guys will indulge me, there's one other thing that I wanted to bring up, and it's this idea of who's the beatdown. Do you guys listen to Limited Resources at all? Have you heard of this particular thought experiment, I guess it is?
I have not.
I have. I'm familiar with the original article, too. I've read it a few times, just being the formerly competitive player that I am. But yeah, I have read it, and I don't know if I apply it to Commander near as much as I should.
So walk us through what the who's the beatdown idea is then, because I've been talking a whole lot and I feel like people want to hear someone's voice who isn't mine.
Well, I'm glad you want to hear my voice, Joey.
I do indeed.
But basically, who's the beatdown is a question that they propose where there's always in a situation, there's one person that's going to be the aggressive person. They're going to be proactively trying to get the other person dead, whereas the other person is, you're not trying to win immediately. You're trying to control the game, control the pace of play. And so realizing basically what is your role within the game? Are you that person that I know, you know, two people are playing kind of the wait for it type commanders. So while they're setting up and while they're waiting to play their game plan out, am I the person that needs to be on either the ASAP plan where I need to get the game over with and I need to turn creatures sideways and force action? Or am I the person that I'm going to wait a little bit longer and they're actually the beatdown and I'm even slower than they are? I'm the blowout commander where they're going to set up a little bit. They're going to try to get their commander down. I might counter it or remove it right away. And then I will then turn the corner a little bit later on. So just kind of figuring out the speed of your deck, where it plays in the situation as far as who else is at the table. What are they trying to do compared to what you're trying to do? And it's, yeah, who's trying to be aggressive, who's trying to be a little bit slower and control the game. That's the main gist of that article.
Yeah, and Marshall and LSV talk about it on Limited Resources podcast as well, and it's always very illuminating, and that's just applying it to the one-on-one games, but in Commander it becomes even more complicated. But if you've got a commander that wants to go ASAP as soon as possible, it therefore is probably prudent or just like a natural conclusion to draw that the person who's got more of the blowout commander could be a bigger threat to you than someone else who's also an ASAP style deck, because you know that your endgame might be less powerful, less superior than the person who's got the blowout sort of style endgame. Like, that's something to consider for sure. And I feel as though as long as we're talking about when you're supposed to play your commander, that's something that we should address as well, because knowing when other people are going to cast their commanders can also help you, you know, figure out how to destroy them, and also just which of them is your biggest enemy. Like, that's a difficult thing too. You usually sit down with three opponents. It's tough to know which one you want dead first.
But it's a very useful thing to start teaching yourself to do, is at least do that look around the board and be like, okay, that commander over there is definitely not one that I'm worried about, and that commander over there isn't going to cast until the board state is in a certain place. And that commander over there, I can't let do anything. That's going to be a blow when it comes down, so I need to be aware of that one. You know, and that takes experience for one, and it helps if you know the player and their deck, because that can change from player to player and from deck to deck. But it's a useful thing to bear in mind at the start of every game and to keep an eye on over the course of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. It's super, super complicated. Hopefully we've managed to shed a little bit of light on the topic and just, you know, inviting people to look critically at not just the role that their commander is playing, but also the when of the commander too, because that can definitely help you lead to victory down the line. For now, though, I think that we ought to move to our final segment, challenging the stats. There are a lot of statistics on EDH Rec. But, you know, we don't always agree with them. Sometimes we think cards are seeing more play than they deserve or less play than they deserve. So we'd like to challenge those statistics here. Matt, what is your challenge to stats this week?
So on my Valdec deck that I've talked about, trying to figure out, do I wait for it a little bit? Do I set up? I was kind of brushing up and seeing some of the new cards that people have been putting in decks. And I think there's one that's showing up a little bit higher than it should. That sword actually, and I know I'm going to get some flack for this, is Sword of Sinew and Steel. It is the new Modern Horizons Sword of X and Y. It is 3 mana for an equipment. It says when an equipped creature gets +2/+2 and has protection from black and protection from red. Whenever the equipped creature deals combat damage to a player, destroy up to 1 target planeswalker and up to 1 target artifact. And its equip cost is 2 mana. Not that I'm saying this is a bad artifact, but I think a lot of people are putting a fair amount of auras into Valdec decks. And if that's the case, giving Valdec protection from red backfires really, really hard. There's stuff like Dragon Mantle, which is a very, very commonly played card. Bravado. There's all sorts of auras that you want to be putting on Valdec that are very, very powerful, that really help punch damage through, that I don't think you want to be putting, I don't think you want to be putting Sword of Sinew and Steel into Valdec decks for that very reason. Currently, it's only showing up in 38% of decks since Sword came out, but I think that number should be much lower than it is.
38% of decks made with Valdec as the commander since Sword of Sinew and Steel are playing Sword of Sinew and Steel?
Yes.
That seems very high to me. That I completely agree with you. That seems like a total non-bow.
Yes, non-bow is a perfect way to put it. I mean, there are so many times where, man, I can't even think of all the great auras that red has, because you want a lot of cheap effects to get out there. Hammerhand is one of my favorites, or Cartouche of Zeal, Mob Mentality. There's a lot of really good auras out there that help you punch damage through. Elemental Mastery is one of the most explosive cards in a Valdec deck, and you can't do that with Sword of Sinew and Steel. And the poopy part about that is, if you put Sword of Sinew and Steel onto Valdec after you have 2 or 3 auras on there, they fall off.
Right.
I think that should be a much, much lower number. Unless you're playing purely equip artifacts on Valdec, I don't think you want to be playing Sword of Sinew and Steel.
Matt, I really like your challenge this week. I super agree. I've also faced your Valdec deck firsthand, and I've seen how absolutely disgusting it can be, and how obnoxious those auras can in fact be. So yeah, super, super on board. I'm going to move to my challenge the stats now, and I'm trying to do this as sort of an olive branch to both you guys, because I know that you had a bit of a spat last week about the card Amulet of Vigor. Dana had used that as his challenge to stats, saying that it was showing up too much, and Matt pushed back saying, no, this card's actually amazing. Dana, you're wrong, and I hate you. So I'm
true.
Trying to
that,
find
that's,
a card.
That's
word for word how it went.
So I'm trying to find a card that I think hopefully we can all agree on. Amulet of Vigor is really cool because when a land enters the battlefield tapped under your control, it'll untap it. But I've got another creature that I can't believe I haven't challenged the stats on previously. I went through previous shows to make sure that I hadn't already challenged this. This is one of my favorites. It's the card Stone Cedar Hierophant. This is a 4-mana green creature, human druid. It's a 1/1, but let's be real. You don't care about its power and toughness. You care about its ability. It says whenever a land enters play under your control, you untap the Stone Cedar Hierophant, and it can tap to untap target land. This thing is bonkers. If you are playing a landfall deck, this needs to be in your deck yesterday. Amulet of Vigor has a timing restriction, which, you know, the land actually has to enter tap. It doesn't even matter for Stone Cedar Hierophant. You can tap it to untap one of your lands and then tap that land and then play a land and untap your Stone Cedar Hierophant and then tap it and then untap that land and get more mana. And the only drawback of this card is that it can be a little bit complicated with all of the amazing, delicious triggers that you can get from this thing. You can untap tons and tons of lands at basically a moment's notice. I think that this is a great value engine that will allow you to get, you know, really great use out of lands that produce, you know, more than 1 mana, for example. I think this card's amazing, but criminally, it is only seeing play in 608 decks total. And I just don't think that's right. Specifically, what I'd like to compare it to, though, is the card Lotus Cobra. Lotus Cobra is currently showing up in 49% of land theme decks. And I'm just like, I can't believe that, because I think that I do think that Stone Cedar Hierophant is a better card than Lotus Cobra. That's just sort of how I feel, because it can let you use the mana at any time as opposed to the one-shot effect of Lotus Cobra. But Stone Cedar Hierophant is not showing up on the land theme page on EDH Rec at all. And I just don't think that that's not right. So while you guys squabble about Amulet of Vigor, I'm going to put forward that more people in land theme decks need to be playing Stone Cedar Hierophant.
I will make a rare move and agree with Joey.
I
definitely agree that this is probably the card that a lot of people want Lotus Cobra to be. I've always been really underwhelmed, and I took Lotus Cobra out of pretty much all of my decks because I just didn't think it was really worth putting that in there, the opportunity cost of only getting one mana. I think it's more of a 60 card type of format card in Lotus Cobra. Stone Cedar Hierophant, yeah, that is a pretty spicy number.
I've used this to untap Cabal Coffers probably 4 times in one turn. That alone is just absolutely nasty. But even if you're not playing the color black and have Cabal Coffer stuff going on in here, just untapping like a Gruul Turf or something to get multiple mana out of it, like this thing is bonkers, bonkers powerful. And I just think that more people need to see it because it's so good. There are plenty of moments where this is my most valuable creature on the board when I'm playing a landfall deck. So yeah, it's really, really spicy. Dana, what's your challenge?
My challenge is for a blue enchantment that's only in about 1,200 decks right now on EDH Rec, but I'm going to focus on 3 commanders in particular. The enchantment is Gravitational Shift. It's 5 mana enchantment that gives all creatures with flying +2/+0, and all creatures without flying -2/-0. In the 3 decks in particular I think it's underplayed in are 3 decks that are in blue that tend to make a ton of tokens. The first two in particular usually win via some kind of token beatdown. That would be Talran Sky Summoner. Gravitational Shift is in 14% of Talran decks, and it's in 11% of Locust God decks. The third one is a little more forgivable. It's Una, Queen of the Fae, and I think Una tends to be maybe a combo deck more than a token beatdown deck. But it's still only in 8% of Una decks, and that's definitely not the amount of those that are token or fairy decks. It's won me a lot of games in Talran, both by turning those drakes into 4/2s from 2/2s, which significantly changes the math when it comes to killing somebody. But don't underestimate the fact that it gives creatures without flying -2/-0 either. There's a lot of decks that just shuts down as well. And if you are in one of those 3 token-making decks that tends to go wide and tends to have almost exclusively flyers, there's so much upside to Grav Shift, both defensively and offensively, and it should be in more decks.
I think Gravitational Shift just also sort of kind of ties back to today's theme. Like, anthems are also one of those things that you want to try and time very carefully too, right? Like, you can't play an anthem out onto an empty board. It'll totally neutralize you. Gravitational Shift does have the minus ability that can certainly save you, which does give it some extra juice there, which is awesome. But generally speaking, yeah, Gravitational Shift or Coat of Arms, you play them as the blowout type of things people don't see coming, and then with all of the presence you've built up on the battlefield, it suddenly wipes people out. Dana, I do have to ask, just to try and, you know, play devil's advocate or keeping you honest or whatever, the way that you play Talrend, you've stated before, is different than how a lot of other people build Talrend, though, right? Do you think that might color your impression of Gravitational Shift at all? Or do you still think that even the folks who are playing the control-y, counterspell-y type of Talrend should still be running this particular card?
I think particularly Talrend, you still probably should be considering it. You still have to win the game. Like, you can play a control, counterspell, Talrend deck all you want. You still have to kill people with something. And maybe that isn't your plan one, but it's probably a plan in that deck. Maybe you're going to go for some kind of a Labman combo or something. Maybe that's what your plan A is, but that can't be your only plan, and I still think it's worth a shot even then. I think Una is the one I mentioned last. It's in the least amount of Una decks. I think that one definitely tends to probably lean more into combo wins, and maybe in that case, you know, Fairy Beatdown is plan D. But I definitely think Talrand particularly and Locust God particularly, I don't think that's a plan D. I think that's maybe a plan B at worst case. And I think being able to run one single card that makes your plan B way easier to pull off is worth a slot.
All right. I dig it. I certainly do. So, guys, any other final thoughts about the topic of timing your commander that you want to share before we wrap up the show?
I think it's a really useful thing to think about, and I would really recommend you kind of think about it for all of your decks. I don't think it's the kind of thing that you need to devote hours and hours to, but I think also you should roughly know going in when the optimal time to cast that commander is and how to evaluate other people's commanders and board states to tweak that when you need to. It's a useful skill to have. There's not much downside to it, and it's something people need to think about more often.
I think the partner example that you had brought up earlier is a great way to try and trick your brain into figuring that out as well. If it's, you know, if a commander is really, really difficult, you're not sure quite where it's going to be. Imagine that it has partner with another commander. And then you sort of compare those two directly and see, well, which one would I play first? Which one would I play after? And why? Like, that can be a really easy way to sort of finagle your brain into a place where it can start to try and examine that, because it's difficult. This is not easy. And in the course of this very show, I found out that I was playing a commander maybe in a way that wasn't as conducive to its long-term game plan. I'm going to go and check on that Drana deck there, Dana. Thank you very much for the for the tip. But yeah, like, it's complicated to try and figure it out, but try and look for different ins to it, because it's definitely fruitful. I feel like you're going to win more games when you play your commander at the right time. Just saying.
Yeah. I agree with everything that we have said today for the most part.
Oh, for the most part.
I don't know. I just wanted to make sure I was keeping everybody honest.
Alrighty, and with that, we're going to call this episode to a close. I'd like to thank my co-host so much for joining me, and if any of our listeners would like to get in touch with us, where can they find you all? Matt?
You can find me on the Twitters at Mathimus55, that's MathImus55.
And Dana?
You can find me on Twitter at Dana Roach, and you can hear me twice a week on the other podcast, CMDR Central.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me at Joseph M. Schultz on Twitter. Special thanks to our editor for the show, Ken Peddle, also known as Kenish Norn. You can follow him on Twitter at Loader. That's LOAD3R. You can follow EDHREC and the cast on Facebook and Twitter, and you can contact us at EDHRECcast@gmail.com. Plus, you can find us on iTunes. And if you do, please consider leaving us a review to help other folks find the podcast as well. This cast is posted every week on EDHREC's Community Content Spotlight section, where we feature as many other content creators as we can, from Command Zone to Commander's Brew to Commander Versus, not to mention new articles published every day by our own fantastic team of writers. We'll be back at you next week with more data and insights, but until then, remember, EDH wreck your deck before you wreck your deck.
Well, we were having that conversation about old movie stuff at Commander Night last week, I think it was, and one of the guys we were playing with mentioned, he's like, have you watched The Wizard of Oz at some point in recent history? Because at some point, the Scarecrow actually pulls out a gun. I was like, what? And he brought up stills on his phone, and I'm like, I did not remember that at all.
And the lion has some stupid weapon. He has like a net or something.
Yeah, he's like a net, and the Tin Man has an axe, but the Scarecrow actually is packing a revolver.
That's... And those old movies never seem to have the same charm, do they?